Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 58. We're recording this on March 1st of 2019. And this is a bit strange because I expected this time of the year to be quiet in terms of announcements from photographic industry companies, whether it be camera manufacturers or software vendors. But we have been hit with a ton of news in the last week. And I know somebody that's had his hands on some of the latest and greatest cameras and has been testing all of the bits and pieces and is a real true geek. And I'm just thrilled to welcome back Jordan Drake. Jordan, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great, Don. How are you?
Crazy busy. I mean, I'm still doing my Snowflake series for about another 2 or 3 weeks now at this point. So that's eating into all of the time that I'd rather be experimenting and tinkering in the studio. Got a bunch of people that ordered some prints from me, so putting those together and just kind of a general, you know, running the business kind of thing. You don't know what you're doing when you wake up in the morning as an entrepreneur. So every day is a different story. How about yourself? Like, what's new and exciting in your world?
Well, we're just putting the finishing touches on the Canon RP video that should be up probably by the time everybody hears this. Their entry-level full-frame camera, which is kind of interesting.
I want to get your opinion on that because we talked about it in a previous episode, and I know that you've had your hands on all of the new offerings that have been announced from Canon and from Fuji. And so when I was talking about that recently, I believe it was Steve Brazel that I had on, and you were actually listening to that episode. I know you're privy to the conversation. So were we on the mark with that, or how was the hands-on experience with those cameras?
Well, I mean, that's a really difficult camera because that sensor in it is the old 6D Mark II sensor, which is pretty similar, honestly, to like a 5D2 or something like that, maybe a 5D3. So when people are looking at a full-frame camera, when you're looking at that price point, it's always, what are you going to get stepping up over an APS-C or a Micro Four Thirds sensor? And it's generally shallower depth of field, better low-light performance, and a dynamic range increase. And that one's weird because the dynamic range bump isn't there. We rated it lower than a lot of the current APS-C cameras out there. And honestly, pulled up some of the DP Review dynamic range tests, and it's pretty close to a lot of the modern Micro Four Thirds sensors.
I mean, you do sacrifice something when you go to a very small sensor in terms of high sensitivity performance, and in some cases, dynamic range as well. So the fact that it's lagging behind, especially on the camera that they are really promoting for the masses, that is concerning to me. I mean, I know that Canon, I expected that they wouldn't have built a brand new sensor for this camera because it would have upped the R&D costs considerably. But I think they might have made the wrong choice of what they already had taped out to put into this camera body.
The only thing I can really think is they're expecting the majority of people grabbing that to be shooting JPEGs, where the dynamic range of the sensor is, you know, basically a moot point anyways. And it is very competitive at high ISOs, so I could see for low light shooting and stuff like that, it's still kind of making sense.
Right.
Be an interesting astro camera, honestly.
Yeah, quite possibly, especially because you've got the larger sensor. But compared to, because you also have been hands-on with Fuji's latest offering too, right? And we were kind of debating the value proposition based on the number of dollars you were putting into these two cameras. How did you find that one?
I far preferred the X-T. I love that camera. I'm supposed to ship it back today, and I'm dreading that because I've had a lot of fun shooting with it. For the price, it's just phenomenal, especially if you have any interest in video as well as stills. It's a beautiful image coming off that thing. For $900 American, it's crazy.
Yeah, and you might already have an invested interest in the Fuji system, and you might already have lenses, but even if you want to get a basic kit lens, it only upped the cost by $100 or something to get a lens inside the box with the camera.
Yeah, their basic lens for that. And they're still kitting it with their beautiful 1855, which I think is still one of the best kit lenses ever made.
Well, I'm glad that your hands-on insight kind of echoes our armchair quarterback discussion that we had just looking at the specs. So that's valuable for me. Looking forward to seeing what else is going to come out. You're always putting out great videos through DP Review TV. And they're some of the most informative and everybody has their biases, but you guys try to be as unbiased as possible with your commentary, which I find delightful because you don't get that everywhere you look.
Yeah, generally, we always try to look at everything with an open mind, and you're going to bring something to the table all the time. You know, I was a Canon shooter for a very long time, and they disappointed me for a while, so I really have to kind of push that to the back of my mind when I'm looking at these. Try and keep an open mind, because, you know, they hurt my feelings. It's like seeing an ex every once in a while, right?
Well, you know, they hurt my feelings, too. I was still waiting for the longest time for the 1DX Mark II that has dual-pixel autofocus to have dual-pixel RAW support. And it never came. And I didn't. Yeah. I don't think it ever will. So not that it would be a huge benefit to me, but, you know, throw a guy a bone once in a while. Treat me like your flagship customer because I'm buying your flagship products.
Yeah, it's crazy they haven't given you a C-Log as well on that body, but they brought it out on the 5D4. That's bizarre to me.
Yeah, it seems so strange because you want the pros, the people that are spending top dollar, to have top features. And Olympus has done this with the EM1X. You know, they've just loaded that thing with tons of stuff that usually you see from the other manufacturers. They'll roll into the sort of the second tier bodies as a proving ground, and then they'll flip that onto the top tier bodies afterwards. But Olympus says all in, and so there's some interesting stuff happening there. We won't get back into the stories that we covered in previous episodes. We've got a lot to cover this week. And the first one, which I wanted to talk about last week, didn't have the time, is Adobe has rolled out a new AI-powered enhanced detailed features, like on those CSI shows where they say zoom in and enhance. And they say it promises up to 30% more resolution for raw images. Now, I thought this was pretty interesting because, you know, AI is, in the smartphone world, it's everywhere. It's always enhancing your images behind the scenes, whether you realize it or not. But we haven't had a whole lot, aside from some resolution enhancing algorithms from, I believe it was Topaz has theirs, but a big guy like Adobe rolls out AI-powered enhanced details. So a few things for the groundwork here. It only applies to raw data, which makes me think that they are doing something really interesting in the demosaicing process of the data. And we'll get into what that might be. And it's like all AI has to be trained on specific subjects. So if you do a lot of portraiture, it might, you know, detect certain features in faces and enhance them, or architecture and understand, you know, what a traffic light or, you know, what a window on a building might look like and learn how to enhance some of those particular details. And that means it's not trained on everything. So this is not going to be that, every image I take now is going to have a 30% increase in performance. Now, I don't know if you've played with this one at all yet, Jordan.
No, I haven't yet. I'm out of the Adobe ecosystem. We kind of jumped over to Capture One as our primary editing program last year. And then for video, jumped over to Final Cut. So I'm Adobe free. So I'm very curious about your perspective on this, because I think this is what we're going to start to see from all of the post-production suites. It makes a ton of sense.
Right. Well, what was really curious for me, though, is that it is RAW only. And I tried to feed a TIFF file through it, and it says, nope, unsupported format has to be RAW, which means if we go back a little bit and understand what the raw data is, there's a color filter array in front of the camera sensor. The majority of cameras out there have an array called a Bayer pattern, which is alternating green, blue, green, blue, green, blue, and the next row is red, green, red, green, red, green, so on and so forth, such that if you have a block of four, you have a red in the bottom left corner, a blue in the upper right corner, and the other one are two green, and that will flip and flop. So the fact that they need this pre-pixel information, the fact that they are requiring this sort of photo site level information, and the other one is, of course, the X-Trans sensors that Fujifilm is using in all of their cameras. They just have a different array of these colors. But that, I wonder what secret sauce they're rolling into that. Because if that's a requirement, one of the examples that they gave on some of these websites as a demoing is the enhanced details versus the regular demosaicing technique does a much more accurate depiction of streetlights and traffic lights. And of course, the traffic lights in the example image are red, and it knows very well to color them all solidly red rather than having some of the pixels not being red. And that might be something you can train on a demosaicing level, where you can identify what red photo sites should be activated in between and better calculate what these values should be. On top of that regular machine learning, understanding that that's a traffic light, how do we apply this information to it?
Yeah, I think where we're really going to see it is those really solid primary colors that tend to give all of these processors a real issue, especially with X-Trans. Yeah. And I think that's, we've been wondering for a while, why is Adobe lagging so far with processing X-Trans files? And I think it's just that they've been working on this forever and hadn't been making any improvements to their older algorithms.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think where we're going to see this, like a traffic light is a perfect example of something that should be primary red, very contrasty compared to its surroundings, which most image processors would say, oh, that's an issue there. You know, there's some sort of glitch going on, where with this, yeah, if it can say, hey, we've got a traffic light there, or any other example of that very bright primary that you might see, I think that'll make a lot of sense.
Exactly. But when you also get into issues where this was a while back. I think the first Canon camera that removed the anti-aliasing filter was the 50DSR. You could get the 5DS.
5DSR,
yeah. 5DS and the 5DSR. The R had the little filter that basically blurred things removed. Because what happens is with this pattern, if it's so accurate, and you've got a very, very fine pattern, you have something called moiré that comes in, wonderful French word, where you might have even seen this if you ever try to like take your cell phone and like photograph an LCD screen. It's got these weird patterns on it. That's probably the most scenario where people would see it evidently. And that would happen in camera sensors. And it would be a big problem because of the fact that every photo site isn't recording every single bit of information. Now, with artificial intelligence, in the same example with the traffic lights, there is a power line running through the frame that is like sub-pixel detailed. And in one part of it, it kind of breaks up a little bit. But in the AI-enhanced detail version, it knows that that should be a smoother pattern, and it's able to interpret that information a little bit better. So this, I think, will be a helpful tool when you have those 40, 50 plus megapixel sensors that do not have anything obscuring the details, where moiré could come in a little bit more prominently, and now Adobe might have a solution for that. But it has to be trained. And so I fed it some examples of my imagery using some water droplet refraction imagery, some snowflakes, a freezing soap bubble, just, you know, the macro stuff that I might be doing. Absolutely zero impact whatsoever. It did nothing, because it's not. It's clearly not going to be trained on those subjects that are right. in the niche.
You're one of like 10 people who are making that.
Exactly.
Their main cake.
Exactly. And maybe the learning will expand over time, and it will hit more and more features, I'm sure. It's not something that Adobe is just going to push out and say, yep, set it and forget it. You know, this is just something that we'll never touch again. It's just a button you can now check. I've got a feeling that in every subsequent release of Adobe Camera Raw or Lightroom, you're going to see enhancements to this particular workflow. So that said, it does absolutely nothing for me right now. It's a little bit disappointing. And it also, it's not just like a checkbox that automatically changes the way the engine works. It has to generate a brand new file. And so if I was to be doing like a focus stacking workflow or an HDR workflow or something where I want, and you have to do it at the raw level, for every component image that you want to put into the system, you have to then, for every one of them, convert them using this enhanced detail feature before you can take advantage of that pushing forward. So there's a couple of roadblocks here to usability. But if it gets you, you know, if you have images that you haven't processed from lower resolution cameras, you know, years ago, and you want to give them a second chance at getting processed and maybe even printed, and this would give you a better output at the final end. So more power to Adobe for doing this. And I'm glad that they're using the raw data and interpreting that differently. But we still have a very long way to go before it's universally viable for us to start, you know, actively adding this to our workflow, I think.
Yeah, how did you find the performance on that? That's the one thing I was very curious about, doing the actual conversions compared to just doing like a regular DNG conversion.
It took a lot longer.
Okay.
And it was weird because it took a lot longer and it did nothing. I mean, like, right. it had to run through all of its pre-programmed case scenarios and understand that none of that really applied to that. And I kind of wish that Adobe would spit out a percentage of what it assumes the increase in resolution and quality is going to be. Because if I'm doing that to my images just on just as par for the course, you know, or just going to do this every single time, if I know that it's making a 0% impact on my macro photography work, but it's doing a 20 to 30% impact on street photography or travel photography, then there are certain subjects that I won't even bother touching with it, and others that I will make sure I reprocess everything through it. But there's no indication aside from your own visual inspection on the two different files.
Right. I'm very curious. I really like the idea of moving some of this machine learning to post, because I feel like so much of what we're seeing with it right now is like in smartphone photography, where it's doing it almost in real time, or in a lot of the autofocus algorithms that things like the Panasonic S1 are doing. They're really a bit hampered with how much they can access, because it has to be doing it, you know, 60 or 120 times per second while it's focusing, where being able to move it to the back end here, you know, it might be way more processor intensive, but it could potentially do a way better job once they get more images in there.
Yeah, and if it took, you know, four times as long, but it did give me a decidedly improved image, you know, I for an award-winning shot, I'm all for that, right? Give me the best results possible. I don't care if I have to watch a progress bar for 30 seconds. You know, I'll have Netflix on at the same time anyhow, so it doesn't really matter. But the one thing that we have to be aware of here is using machine learning and AI interpretation of data, it is guessing, and it's going to guess really well in some cases, and they're not showing any cases where it's guessed incorrectly. I'm certain there are those use cases too, where it's trained on one thing, it's made the incorrect guess as to what that is, and it's giving you less accurate information. That's not talked about in any of these articles, and I couldn't find an example of it through my own initial tests, but theoretically, it's no longer truthful. It's being interpreted by a learning algorithm, and so you have to take that. You know, photojournalists, of course, would avoid this type of processing, anything that would possibly impact the integrity of the work. The average person, it's probably not a big impact, but there are some caveats there, too.
Yeah, I'm sure eventually it's going to see sunglasses and think it's a traffic sign at some point, and it'll be horrifying, but we'll see. We'll see when we get there. I do really want to see maybe some of your listeners, if they want to process some Xtrans. I think that's where you'll really see the difference, because we know that Adobe Camera Raw does a great job with your Panasonic files, Canon files, things like that. It's always struggled with Xtrans. So maybe, you know, it would be worth it just to get a new updated algorithm for working through those Xtrans files. That might be where it's worth the extra processing time.
I would think so. And so we'll see. Again, the Xtrans has a much different array, and you can't apply the same Bayer pattern logic to it and output the same results. You have to think differently with it. And so hopefully they've built that into this new algorithm from the ground up, because when they developed their original raw decoding, the Xtrans pattern didn't exist. There was no ground level, okay, we're starting from scratch and introducing two separate systems. It was kind of bolted onto the existing platform, and that's where you get those results.
Yeah.
Right? All right, well, let's go into another fun story. This one, to me, is... I just love oddities in photography. You know, in previous episodes, we've talked about cameras that look like machine guns for training in World War II, and and all sorts of bizarre spy cameras and things like that. I love the lenses that are produced and cameras on the fringes, that they might make a dozen of them, and they serve a very unique and interesting case. So this is, it's been reported in quite a number of places, but this article I found from Petapixel. The widest ever 4.9 millimeter fisheye lens can see behind itself. Now, fisheye lenses have been able to see behind themselves for quite some time. Nikon had, I think, a 6 millimeter fisheye lens that they produced.
7 mil, yeah.
7 millimeter, way back when. And again, they probably sold them in double digit numbers. And it was, if I can recall, around 210 degree of field of view. So again, beyond the 180 that would see, you know, your peripheral vision behind your head. Or beside yourself. So 270 degrees is what this thing can do. If you could imagine, and on the article that will be in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com, in order for it to have that degree of a view, the bulbous front element has to just be ridiculous. ridiculously like massive and rounded in order for this to happen. Now, this lens is being manufactured by a man who I love seeing teardowns of cameras and lenses. And if you haven't read any of Roger Sakala's, if that's how I pronounce his name, camera or lens teardown stuff, it's humorous and incredibly informative at the same time. He's the guy behind Lens Rentals. He's the founder there. And he is building this lens as a part of a new venture called C4 Optics. And first of all, Jordan, what do you think about this kind of wacky design? It's like, oh, you're making it just because you can sort of thing. I kind of like that mentality.
I think it is. If they're like, hey, I'm starting a new lens venture, how are we going to get some attention? Make something that's never been made before. And I mean, that Nikon lens is famous. I think they go for, you know, a small fortune right now on the used market. And here we've got something even wider, probably a little more accessible. I think it's I don't need this lens. I have no practical application, but I'd sure love to use it for a weekend.
There is I think it's a Chinese or Taiwanese manufacturer out in Asia that makes a 250 degree fisheye lens for Micro Four Thirds systems, and that's been out for a while. It's a multi-thousand dollar setup if you want to get it, and you can kind of piece it together for different sensors, different considerations. This one looks like it's designed for the full frame mount. I couldn't find any complete confirmation on that, but based on its size, there's nothing else that it would be designed around. And they say the front element alone costs them about $5,000 to manufacture. Just that piece of glass is $5,000 for the manufacturing costs. And if you look at their design, there's I don't know how many. There's at least four or five pieces of larger specialized glass before you get into the more standardized smaller elements on the inside to bring things together. And that means this, to make one, I'm just going to guess, is going to cost between $10,000 and $15,000 to manufacture.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, they got to make money on them, right? So you're going to be looking at $20,000 to $30,000 in terms of a retail price.
Yeah, I'm guessing 30.
I'm thinking around 30, although if they're selling them direct, they might be able to sell them a little cheaper rather than having the retail cut. And I don't think a lot of retailers are going to be stocking stuff like this. So, yeah. It's the kind of thing that I might want to rent. But then you look at that big bulbous element, and I don't know if even Lens Rentals, I mean, clearly they're tied in here. I don't think Lens Rentals would rent one of these things because that is so easy to damage. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, you buff out a scratch, but that's not, you don't do that with a $5,000 piece of precision optics on the outside of that thing. So we'll see. I would love to get my hands on one at some point, but C4 has also, they had previously announced a 66.6mm f0.66 beast of a lens, as we can call it that. I mean, it's clearly going after that moniker. Again, something that we've never seen before and would be ridiculously expensive. So the fact that they're out there doing these wonderful weird lenses for me to just have as eye candy, it's lovely. What would I use it for? Well, they did show an image in the comments on one of the articles that I found where it shows it defished. So you take the fisheye image and you spread it back out towards a regular panorama of a room, and it actually performs really quite nicely in that defishing algorithm. So people doing VR stuff, it could be very useful for there. Imagine having two of these side by side for stereo VR. It would be just crazy. But at the same time, yeah, that's like a $50,000 to $60,000 investment. If you're going to get two of these things, they'll have a very, very small market.
Yeah, but I mean, it's great to see it out there, and I could really see that being useful for something where you generally try to build like a panorama, stitch an image together. But if you have to capture it in a single exposure, like I could see you doing something really cool, hanging this above a sporting event or something like that.
Oh yeah, that'd be cool.
And you capture that one moment and the reaction at the exact same second, something where you usually can't do it with a pano.
True enough, although you don't really need to see behind yourself if it's hanging from the ceiling in that case, right?
So. You don't need to see behind yourself. I don't want to see. No, I mean, it's such a niche lens, but it's cool.
Where you can get the entire night sky and the ground and everything else around you all within the frame. Yeah, there is some use cases that could play into that. I wish them well in their endeavors of making these freaky, unusual lenses that are for very small niches, and I want more of that, please. Which brings me to a question, Jordan. What is the most unusual camera lens that you have personally had your hands on?
I think the Laowa probe lens is probably my number one. Have you got yours yet?
Yeah, I do. It's sitting in a box right behind me. I don't know why it came in a special metal case with little locking latches on it. That seems a little bit superfluous. But I haven't had a chance to use it yet. I've got a ton of different ideas. The opportunities haven't come up. But in the same line of lenses, there's a company called Infinity Optics or Infinity Optical. And they make the TS-160. Which is very reminiscent of the Laowa probe lens. It's got almost exactly the same figure. You can put a regular a macro optic on the front of it, and it'll go from infinity up to 1:1. Or you can put a compound microscope objective on the front of it, and it'll go from infinity all the way to 16 times magnification within the same lens and optical formula, which is just bizarre. But it's a compound microscope idea. So have you ever looked through a compound microscope?
No.
Everything's backwards. You know, you're trying to move to the left, but the things move to the right, and it's just, you have to mentally train yourself. It's like if you were to rewire the handlebars on a bicycle and they go the opposite way, you'll be falling down for at least a couple of weeks before your brain retrains itself to figure that out. But it was a really fun lens to use and experiment with.
Have you ever used a waist level viewfinder? Is it similar to that?
Kind of, except it's even worse because it's you're working at extreme magnification, so the slightest little adjustment, you know, throws something out of the frame, right. And so you have to mentally prepare yourself for it. Who needs to go from infinity to 16:1 magnification? Well, I could see some really fun trick shots, you know, where you've got, you know, somebody in a CSI scenario where you've got the wide shot of everybody, you know, investigating the crime, and then you ratchet all the way forward to like some strand of hair in a brush at extreme magnification, where you could see all the different little follicles, or not follicles, but the little like cracks and whatever within the hair itself, in one shot without cutting.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen that use, but that's probably the weirdest lens that I've come across myself. That makes me want this 270 degree lens even more now that I see how unique it is. But anyhow, let's get into the meat of the discussion here. The third story, I didn't want to lead with this because, well, I figure we're going to take a lot of time on it. But so this was reported by F-Stoppers, but I originally saw it from Tony and Chelsea's YouTube channel, where Tony Northrup put out a video basically calling ISO settings fake. And there have been a number of response videos to that, some that agree and some that disagree with him. The one that we're linking to is from F-Stoppers, and it's titled ISO is not fake and Tony Northrup is wrong. Okay, well, I don't think it's quite as black and white as that. So you have some relatively in-depth knowledge of how ISO works and everything, Jordan. At least I trust that you might. So why don't you head this story off and tell us what we're talking about?
Yeah, so about 10 years ago, I remember it was kind of a bit of a brain bender when Red first brought out their cinema cameras. And when I brought it into post-processing, ISO was a slider on it when I brought those raw files in. And I talked to them. They had a program called Reducation for quite a while. And that was the first time I kind of got my... started to figure out how ISO invariance works. So essentially with those cameras, when you dial in your ISO on the camera body, it's taking something shot at the base ISO and just boosting the exposure. And that's what you're seeing in the monitor. But your histogram is displaying what's actually captured there. And then you just slide around in post. So the more you boosted that, the more shadow noise you'd bring in. But there's a reason that that's really useful. And this is the thing that I felt Tony did. And I thought he did a great job bringing this subject to light, because it's something we need to talk about. but I do feel he really missed the advantages of shooting this way. Because we were working on a video about this same subject, and I wanted to call it how to increase your dynamic range and have less fun. Because if we horribly underexpose these images, everyone's saying, well, why would you ever do that? It's because you retain, if you boost your shadows five stops, that means you're retaining five stops of highlight information. And this is something that I felt Tony didn't really touch on his video. He said, just dial in the brightness after the fact. But if I use too high a sensitivity when I take an image and then try to bring back those highlights, I mean, you know what happens, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
All your listeners do as well. There's nothing there.
Let's go back to ISO and variance, because I think that was a really important point of distinction here, because the average consumer camera doesn't function exactly that way. Right. So the high-end RED cinema cameras, and people have been testing the Sony a7 III, and it's ISO invariant to a point, within certain parameters, but not within all parameters. If you really do laboratory testing, I'm sure you'd be able to find more differences that the human eye could not normally detect. But let's talk about how the sensor operates. Because you've got the photo sites that we were mentioning in the first story that are collecting light. They're not collecting light as photons. They're converting that to voltage. And so it stores all of this voltage on the sensor. It's sort of like an analog signal. And then it has to go through an analog to digital converter, an ADC. Yep. And in that process, it turns it into the ones and zeros that then get written to the memory card. If you increase your ISO, what happens in most cases is that once that's been converted to those numbers, it just increases those numbers, right? So they just say, okay, well, we got this raw data off of the sensor, because the sensor only has one effective setting. At least most of them, there are some that have dual, but and we might get to that. But most camera sensors will only have one sensitivity. And so in order to increase your ISO, it's like you're turning up the gain on a stereo. Right. And so, if you're right up close to it and it's sounding nice, that's great. But if you want to listen to it while you're doing housework and you're moving around and you're in another room or something, you can turn it up. But then when you're that far away and turning up the audio, it might have the same volume level, but you might not have the same nuances in the signal. Right. Yes. I think that's a fair analogy. In this case, if you were to talk about ISO and variance in the sense that you have very similar features, there's always going to be something wherever you're boosting the signal. If you're not boosting it right at the beginning, but you're boosting it at a later point or somewhere else, then you're going to have issues where there's some contamination, some extra noise that gets into the mix. I might liken it to... If you were in another room, that same stereo scenario, and you left it at its low volume level, you didn't boost it there, and then you went into another room and you put your hearing aids in so that you could still hear it, but you got a fan on in the room too, right? There's something else. There's a clock ticking on the wall. You know, there's some little things. Your chair might be squeaking, and all of that is getting amplified with the signal of the proper sound that you are trying to hear from another room without turning up the volume. Does that analogy make sense?
Totally, yeah.
Right. So when you are increasing the ISO on your camera, it's boosting it right there at the analog to digital converter. And so that then prevents noise from coming in at a later stage with the majority of consumer cameras. However, if your camera is capable of shooting at a very low ISO setting and retaining, let's say, the majority of the details within the shadows and everything else, your point was really valid at the beginning, which is if I'm shooting at ISO 1600 to get a decent overall exposure, my highlights, if I've got windows in the room that I'm shooting in because it's dark, but there is light from outside, that's just completely gone. In fact, you actually make a cameo in that scenario in Tony's video at some event, I guess you were both at. I could read your name tag. But at the same time, if I were to shoot that image at a very low ISO so that like most of the image is completely black, and I bring that up in post-processing, well, I still have highlight data in that file. And so that, I think, is more valuable than a little bit of additional noise introduced into the scene. If those highlights are retained, I don't have to do anything like crazy HDR processing and what have you. But therein lies the rub with our consumer cameras, right, Jordan? You can't shoot everything completely underexposed so that the image on the back of your LCD screen appears almost black, because how are you going to judge that you got it right, that the composition and all the motion and everything is exactly the way that you want it to be? The cameras don't give you the option to give you a pseudo ISO to accompany your low setting if it was to be boosted to a certain value, right?
Yeah. And there's some manufacturers that are making workarounds. Like, I know the Fujifilm GFX is a great example of, once you get past 800 ISO, it is shooting everything at 800 ISO and giving you a display on the EVF or the LCD of what that image is going to look like once it's boosted up in post.
So,
and I think that's the right
ISO
course.
ISO system, right? So it has two separate sensitivities within, and again, this is not industry standard yet, but it is coming to be more and more common, which I think is just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. But what I'd love to see is, as opposed to actually... when we're using some of these low settings, especially with these dual gain sensors now, it would be great if every camera was just shooting at the base sensitivity. It's giving you a preview in the viewfinder of the brightness that it anticipates. You're going to adjust that to in post, but always captures it with that maximum amount of highlight information. And that's not what we're seeing on cameras right now, with the exception, again, of RED and some raw shooting video cameras.
Right. And you know, this would be such a paradigm shift for camera manufacturers that this could not be on by default. This has to be something akin to like back button focus, right? Everybody expects the focusing mechanism to be coupled to the shutter. And if you intrinsically remove that, people are not going to know, if they aren't trained to focus, and all of their shots are going to be out of focus. They'll be complaining left, right, and center because they don't understand what exactly is happening. So if that could be like a custom function setting, buried where the pros know where to find it and get the best out of that, and they're trained to identify exactly what this is going to produce for them, I think that would be a fantastic tool to have in all upcoming cameras. And honestly, this is a firmware thing, right? And I don't know if anybody has patents regarding this, but they should get on that right now, because this seems like something really valuable moving forward.
Yeah, that's something I said we were looking at putting a video together for this, and a big part of what slowed us down was figuring out how to give you something like a histogram or a waveform so you can expose properly with that. And we had a few ideas of, you know, say having a histogram, but there's different colors on it indicating the levels of noise within that. So as you got deeper in the shadows, it would indicate, okay, we have information here, but it's going to be this level of noisy. Something like that. And I think that's what we really need to figure out to make the shooting experience work properly. I like what RED does, where it's just got a yellow light and a red light, and it lets you know, like, okay, there's information here, but it's too noisy, or you've still got information, but you're losing color information in the highlights. I'd love to see something like that on a stills camera. And it does seem relatively straightforward, and the benefits would be huge. It's just that right now, when I go shoot a landscape and I want maximum dynamic range, I literally have a tiny dot where the sun is and everything else is black, and push it all up in post. It is zero fun to shoot. And that's for a static situation where, honestly, I could just do some HDR or something like that to do something similar.
Well, here's a scenario too, though, Jordan. In that scenario, if you can bracket ISO for HDR, then you could force yourself to take like 5 or 7 shots where the darkest one is going to be that all dark scene with just the sun in it. But you have in that shot sequence one that is normally exposed, so that you can use that as your in the field judge for whether or not you got the shot. Even though you won't be using those shots, you can then just revert to the really dark one and boost that one up in post. That's at least a workaround right now.
Yeah, it works quite well. The other one that I would recommend is the Sony cameras. If you're shooting HLG, which is a video profile, but you can shoot stills with that enabled, then you're going to get very close to the full dynamic range of the sensor in your histogram. So you can use that to meter. It's going to be an ugly JPEG when it comes out, but the raw file that's captured at the same time will be almost perfectly exposed, as long as you avoid clipping
and
your highlights.
HLG stands for hybrid log gamma, if anybody wants to look that up. And that's coming to more and more cameras. I think it's coming to the Panasonic S1s as well.
Yep. But it's a great way to meter. But the big thing is, those are examples where you could, you know, do some bracketing, or you know, can figure out what's going to happen. Where I find this so useful is recently we were doing a shoot and we had backlit skateboarders. And that's a situation where I can't just do some bracketing to preview what that exposure is going to be. So I was there shooting exposed for the highlights and getting black frames on it. And you just have to hope while you're out there. But it's giving you the option to capture fast moving subjects with a huge dynamic range. And that's the real appeal of this for me.
Well, and so the rebuttal video that I linked to and we'll share in the show notes from Dave McKeegan, he also makes a pretty good point that, okay, well, what if the base ISO is inconsistent between manufacturers? ISO actually stands for International Standards Organization, and they were in charge of taking over from the American Standards Association, ASA, in defining what film speeds were in the analog era. And so, yes, there's probably inconsistencies about what ISO is from one manufacturer to the next. And it's not like the International Standards Organization is going to run around testing every camera sensor and fining the people that are off spec, because they create standards for just about everything you could imagine across the world. They've got better things to do. But what about the other things? What if your aperture blades, when they snap down to the proper aperture, they don't snap exactly perfectly to the same place? And people find this when they're shooting time-lapse photography. There's a bit of a flicker because the apertures aren't perfectly always going to exactly the same spot. Or what if the shutter that you set to like one one-thousandth of a second ends up being in one shot 1/995th of a second, and the next one 1/1010th of a second? You know, I'm sure that there are some variances all throughout that. And another big one that people don't realize, because it's kind of hidden from us, I might have mentioned it in an earlier episode, is when you get to wide apertures, there's a non-linear response from the camera sensor in this case. So I found one study from Canon, I think it was. I tried to look it up again. I couldn't find it, but I did find another one from Ryerson University that stated that in lab testing, this was for astrophotography purposes, but I'm sure it applies to other things, anything wider than f4 and you start to see a non-linear response, meaning that if you open up your aperture by a stop, you don't get double the amount of light. And the wider and wider you go, the less of an increase you're going to get. So, you know, you've got the coveted, you know, f1.2 lens, which is wonderful for low light, and it's of course, it's bokeh, and it's overall feel of the image. But I had done a test with the Canon 85 f1.2, and I had it properly mounted on the camera, complete manual settings, pointing against a flat gray wall, and I just took a picture, right? And then I slightly dismounted the lens so that the camera didn't know what the aperture setting was, because there was no electronic communication between that. Both shots were shot wide open at f1.2.
Yeah.
The shot at f1.2 without the lens communicating to the camera body was notably darker. Not by a whole lot, maybe by like a third of a stop or so. But this is not recorded in the metadata, even in the hidden maker notes area of the metadata in the camera raw file. It's just automatically being compensated by the manufacturer, because they know that this is an issue with CMOS sensors when you get to incredibly wide lenses. So if you're thinking you're getting a supreme benefit by spending that what you would otherwise spend on a small car to buy the Leica Noctilux f0.95 lens, unless you're shooting on film with that lens, that's going to have almost no difference whatsoever in terms of the amount of light it collects on a modern CMOS sensor.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think this is why it's great we're starting to see T-stops getting measured on some lenses as well, how much light is actually transmitted wide open. And we're guilty of this back when we were doing the Camera Store TV stuff. When we did our low-light tests, it was quite low-light, so we shot them wide open quite a bit. And we were finding exactly what you're seeing there. The camera is boosting the gain to give us the exposure it thinks we should get. So we're actually penalizing the cameras by doing that.
Yeah.
So now we shoot those stopped down quite a bit, and you're actually getting a more accurate representation of what you do. Yeah, what the sensor is doing there.
Yeah,
it takes out some more variables.
There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that, you know, doesn't often get talked about when it comes to the technology that we're using. And yeah, it's not completely accurate. Even when I'm out, I'm doing a lot of snowflake photography this time of the year. And when I'm out shooting, I'll notice that some images are ever so slightly darker or brighter than their counterparts, sometimes as much as like a quarter of a stop. And when I'm doing my manual focus stacking adjusting, in Photoshop, it's got a seamless tones and colors checkbox, which is designed to compensate for that. But when I'm painting in manual fixes, I often have to go into frames that deviate from the average too much and readjust the brightness on those individual frames because something was up. I don't know if the flash gave out too much or too little power, or the aperture blades were inconsistent. Even this happens sometimes when I'm shooting with the aperture blades completely wide open. So there's always going to be something that deviates you from exactly what the camera is saying that it should be. Embrace that. You know, wrap your arms around that, give it a big bear hug, because that's the technology that we're going to be using for a long time to come.
And it's going to keep progressing that way more and more, especially with the mirrorless lenses now. We're starting to really see that.
Exactly. And, you know, as we capture more and more data, you know, we get the higher megapixels and like more video features and what have you, it's just going to just more analysis paralysis, right? You're going to have all of these videos of people pixel peeping, but there's like 10 times as many pixels to peep at. And there's 10 times as many things to complain about because that's the nature of the internet.
Yeah, well, it's going to keep the DP review forums going for the next decade, so that's good.
There we go.
Still have an employer.
All right, let's go on to the final story, talking about the amount of data that we capture. It was a very poor segue, I apologize. But this one,
killed it.
it's been wildly reported. I didn't see it on DP review as of yet, but I found a link to The Verge, so it is definitely mainstream. Sony's new CF Express memory cards offer more than double the speeds of its current fastest cards, and they say availability with 128, 256, and 512 gigabyte versions. Now, this is more important than you think it is, because the CF Express standard, if your camera has a firmware update and it previously supported XQD cards, it can use CF Express cards just fine. So anybody that has a camera with XQD cards and a manufacturer that's willing to just enable their use, this could be a feature that you have coming to your camera very soon, the camera that you already own. And why is this important? These cards can read as fast as 1,700 megabytes a second. It's 1.7 gigabytes a second, and they can write just shy of 1.5 gigabytes a second. That's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to the previous standards that we've had, I've got some XQD cards, and they might top out at like 500 megabytes a second or something of that nature. And the same for CFast cards. There's a hard limit around that half a gigabyte a second based on the amount of bandwidth you could put through their particular protocols. But this is smashing that in the ground. It's not just, oh, wow, we're 20% better. Look at us. We're three times faster based on what we are currently using today. What do you think about that, Jordan?
Well, I think it's got a couple real advantages. I mean, the first one, if this is enabled and your camera's pretty efficient about it, it makes a buffer irrelevant, basically, with every stills camera with an XQD card on it, moving those files around. And, you know, I pay the bills with video, and I think this has a lot of ramifications in that world right now. We're starting to see RAW working its way into consumer video, starting with the Nikon Z6. We're going to start to see more of that, and the bandwidth is insane. I was just testing a Blackmagic Pocket camera, and the practical way to use it is to plug an external hard drive into it while you're recording, which is cool. It gives you that option, but how much more elegant would it be to just slap one of these regular looking XQD cards into it and be able to capture uncompressed RAW? It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and so of course the manufacturer has to offer you some value at that speed throughput, right? You say that it makes the buffer irrelevant if you can push that amount of data, but there's other bottlenecks, right? You've got to, however fast the processor can translate that analog data into digital data, that converter and all the image processor and whatever a controller is in charge of writing things to the memory card. If any of these things are slower than the maximum throughput of the memory card itself, then that's as fast as you're going to get. And so I don't expect that the first flush of cameras that have the capability of writing to these memory cards will hit anywhere near that maximum threshold, especially if they were designed at a maximum threshold of one third of that. Then you might get a maximum best case scenario 50% increase in the amount of data that you can push through. But that opens up a lot of new opportunities, because if the camera wasn't previously capable of recording higher quality video, then mm-hmm. now you can, for example, the S1 and the, I'm shooting with the GH5S right now for some video projects, it cannot produce 422 10-bit files in camera. You need an external recorder to do that. But yep. if you had a faster memory system, then you might be able to. And you might be able to enable even more features and higher quality. As you mentioned, RAW as a video output would be fantastic to have, so long as there's no bottleneck along the way. It looks like now with these cards that it will not be a bottleneck. But if you're shooting at 1.5 gigabytes a second, you're going to yes. fill up like even the fastest cards in like a dozen minutes maybe like yeah. And so I know how much is required, like when you put together a video for DP Review TV, mm-hmm. how much footage in terms of time do you gather for a 10-minute episode?
We probably get about 2 hours, I would guess.
Okay, so you're looking at what, like 20 to 30 terabytes of data yep. if you were shooting at those bit rates. I mean, it doesn't make logical sense from a logistics standpoint anyhow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this would be a thing where it's great to have the option when you're filmmaking or something like that. And I've got a DIT on set. It would be really nice to have just a small XQD format that I could use to record video that's, you know, of a professional standard. But yeah, everybody pushing for the raw video is the person who's never worked with raw video, I've found.
yes, exactly.
There's times where it's great, you know, and it's usually when something goes wrong, it's most useful. So even, I've got a film that'll be coming out here fairly soon, and the stuff that was lit indoors, I could have shot perfectly with that. GH5S is my favorite camera, and there is some stuff in there that's GH5S. I'm curious, if we get that movie into TIFF, you should come out and tell me if you can see the difference there on the big screen.
I'd like to jump see if between, I can figure that out. I'm not sure
between
if
the
could.
Red Dragon. But when you need to save the shot, that's where RAW is great. So yeah, if it's something really difficult, huge contrast, or your light's screwed or something like that, click it over, record a quick couple clips in RAW, and then back to a standard right.
or,
compressed
you know,
format.
You're going to have more and more broadcasters that are going to be putting out HDR content, and yeah. a lot of TVs are supporting that. I don't know how many broadcast signals are being sent in hybrid log gamma, but that's going to be more of a universal standard because it's not license encumbered. And so we're going to see that as a final output product, which is going to require more input information in order to get viable results at the back end of that pipe. And so there's a lot of moving parts to make all of this happen. But if you're just a stills photographer and you want to make sure that that buffer on your camera is no longer an issue, well, Sony is going to be shipping these in early summer of 2019 and the readers at the same time. So that's a couple of months away. Now, I don't know how quickly camera manufacturers are going to state that that they'll have firmware updates. I know Nikon engineers have stated in interviews that they will be making these firmware updates available, which is how I know it's possible. I have the hopes that Panasonic will allow that because the S1 and the S1R will shoot with XQD cards. So fingers crossed on something happening there. I'm kind of bummed because I just spent a lot of money on a 256 gigabyte XQD card, and now I'm going to have to replace that before it's worn out. So that's just the game we play, I suppose.
Yeah, that's going to be your just regular, more laid back raw shooting card, and then you'll have your beast card coming.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's get into the picks of the week. And before we do, I just want to do a quick little addendum here. Last time you were on, I think one of the stories was the micro fogger.
Yes.
And you wanted some feedback on that. It's a really mm-hmm. cool little device. It's got a ton of output, but it still smells like fried glycerin. So
okay.
It's you can't get away from the smell even on the small scale. But it's still really cool. So I just wanted to throw that at you.
Ordering three.
What's that, sorry?
I'm ordering three.
Okay, go for it. I guess I'll start because it's kind of a video topic, and then you can kind of build on that as well. When we were shooting an episode of DP Review TV when I was out in Calgary on macro photography, unfortunately in a quite frigid landscape, you were using the Atomos Ninja V, or is it Ninja 5?
I think V. I don't know.
All right. Roman numerals always confuse me. So the the Ninja V is a really cool little 5-inch or so display that is an external recorder. And we hooked it up to the GX9 that I was shooting with, because you can get output from that to the external recorder that has all of the on-screen stuff that would be on the back of the LCD screen for the camera, which is great for educational purposes. And I thought it was a really handy device to have, but I didn't really have a prominent need for it. Well, I had a company, a public broadcaster in Europe, that asked me for some footage, and they needed the best that I could possibly give them. 422, 10-bit, 50 frames per second, because they're on the PAL standard. And so, I mean, I can get a GH5S from Panasonic. They're one of my sponsors, and so I can loan equipment periodically. And so I got that, and it'll do 420 10-bit at 50 frames per second, but not 422. Or 420 8-bit, I believe.
Yeah.
But in that sense, if I plug it into an external recorder, it can output via the HDMI port exactly what I needed, and the Ninja V can record that. So, you know, I haven't done a whole lot of video work, and it's not that cheap to do this. I mean, I sunk more than $1,000 into it once you get the unit and the batteries and then the terabyte card and everything else that you need to plug that all in. So I'm probably not going to make any money on this gig based on how much footage they actually require. But now I'm outfitted to record that everywhere. And I've been just doing some test recordings for archival stuff that I get asked from documentaries periodically to produce. And I'll have that ready for them at different specs. I'll, you know, set it to 24 frames per second, 60 frames per second, whatever else, so that I've got a good setup. And it's a really cool little external monitor, too. Nice, like incredibly bright. So if you're out in bright sunlight, you can still see everything just fine. And I'm going to be doing some video tutorials and courses and stuff in the near future. So having an external monitor that I can have much closer to me than the actual camera, but out of the frame, is something that I've always been wanting. So it kind of serves double purpose. If you want the best output of any camera today, like any consumer camera, you need to do it through an external recorder. Now, do you need that? No, most cases you probably don't. But if you're working on a future-proof project that's going to be, you know, put out in HDR video, and you want to make sure that you're producing the highest quality data, you know it's going to be you know, color graded with a bunch of other footage, and you just have to have all that information to do that properly to make it all seamless, then I found the Ninja V to be a great little unit, especially because it's compact and easy. It's not like these like heavy rack-mounted stuff and all these things. It's just simple. You plug it in, it picks up the settings from the camera, and you just hit record, and it just does its thing.
Yeah, I've found it's really bulletproof, and honestly seems really well built, because I've been traveling. Every time I go anywhere now, I'm bringing that, which I would never do with an external monitor before this. It's really great. And the other thing that's changed since I was on your show last is we now know that the Nikon Z6 is going to output ProRes RAW to this. And I don't know if you've worked with ProRes RAW, but it gets around so many of those issues that you talked about. They're small files. It runs like a champion. Currently, it's only for Final Cut 10 right now, but that's really kind of an interesting path forward, and it's just cool to know that this little recorder will do RAW. We're just waiting for the cameras to catch up, and I really think Panasonic is going to open this up to some of their models in the next little while.
That would be wonderful, because I'll be shooting with some of those cameras too, and so that would give me even better opportunities moving forward. I love when the capabilities of my equipment gets better over time, you know, compatible with more hardware and more codecs, more data, more quality. This is something that was really hard to do in the past, but because software can catch up to hardware, as we redefine codecs that are either more efficient or we can push out more data because of the formats change, like we were talking about that Sony, the CF Express card, it's using the same PCI Express bus that the XQD cards are. It's just using a different protocol, the NVMe, non-volatile memory express format.
Nice.
That the standards for like really lightning fast computer SSDs are now using to ridiculous speeds. But it's using the same bus, just a different protocol that's more efficient and can throw more data through it at one time. And so these kind of advances mean that our cameras, like when you invest in a good camera and good equipment today, so long as the manufacturers are going to stand behind it, we're going to see them get better as they age, which is almost unheard of in technology.
Yeah. Well, especially in the camera world, they're starting to catch up to that. But we are seeing it for sure. One other thing I wanted to mention is I just received the Shinobi. So if you don't need that external recording capability, you're not going to bother with that. You get the exact same beautiful, bright display with a really nice interface that you were talking about, Don, but in a much lighter, much less expensive
option. How much does that thing go for?
That's $450 American, so like $600.
Right. So the Ninja V on its own was, I think, like $649 US. But then again, you're going to tip over $1,000 US when you add in the recording of the storage medium.
Yeah.
Because a terabyte mini SSD that plugs into the back is not cheap. You can get them in lower capacities too, but the cost difference is relatively minor. So the fact that you can shave off a couple of $100 on the unit, plus you don't have to buy the external storage if you don't need it, that makes it quite attractive.
Yeah, and the weight is the big thing for me. This is something I'd be very comfortable just slapping on a hot shoe, where with the Ninja 5 Ninja V, I still haven't made up my mind.
Should ask them.
I can talk to those guys, I guess. Then that is something where I always find I've got like a safety cable, or I want to constantly double check to make sure it's locked right down.
And it wouldn't need as much of a battery draw if you're not going to be recording all of the data, right? If it's just showing it to you, then you could use a smaller battery, or the larger capacity batteries would last you a lot longer just displaying what you're looking at, which could be an advantage depending on what you want.
Yeah, I was curious about that, tested them, and it does seem if you pull an SSD out of the Ninja V, then battery life seems to be identical with the two of them. So as long as you're using the V as a recorder, just as a monitor, then battery life seems to be the same, which is great. I was kind of expecting that wouldn't be the case.
Very cool. Was that your pick of the week, by the way?
No, I was actually going to talk about my bread and butter light. Have you used any of the Aputure equipment?
Aputure. Yes. Well, they're hit and miss for me because I've had some of my students buy their extension tube kits and they've literally fallen apart the second time they've used them. So, quality control from Chinese manufacturers, I'm assuming they're based out of China, or at least their manufacturing is suspect. Sometimes you hit it perfectly and sometimes it's just garbage.
Yeah.
And they really, if that's where their brand is, some of the stuff, if you can recommend a specific product from them that you love, then I'll recommend it too. But I can't state that for their overall brand.
Yeah, it is very hit or miss on some of those. They had a lens adapter that I had. It was like a built-in variable ND lens mount adapter for Canon to Sony, which sounded perfect because I love the electronic fader on the FS5. But it was quite flaky and not terribly well designed. But their Cobb lights have become really my workhorse lights. And again, going back to that quality control, I had their old Cobb 120D, just an LED light.
What is a Cobb light, just for anybody listening that doesn't know the terminology?
Oh, it's an abbreviation for single light source that's not on the tip of my tongue right now. But essentially, when you're looking at LED panels, historically they've been a big array of small lights. And if you put those close to something, they look absolutely terrible. You get needlepoint lighting all over it, a bunch of shadows everywhere. Especially for what you're doing, I think they'd be effectively useless.
Oh, yeah.
So what these single point light LEDs do is really emulate what you'd see from a traditional strobe or an old hot light back in the day. It's a single light coming out and it's very easy to modify. And that's what I love about them. You can put on a snoot, you can put on a softbox.
How big is the light source overall?
It's a pretty wide beam. Now, you can grab a Fresnel for that. It comes with a reflector on it. Mm-hmm. But it's about 120 degree throw on this with the reflector on it. But the quality of the light on these is beautiful, and it's very high output. Most of these single point lights were roughly equivalent to like a 200 watt tungsten fixture before, where this guy, the 120 is throwing out close to a 1K, and then the new 300D is putting out about equivalent to just under a 2K, I'd say like a 1.7. Which is more than enough light to throw it into a big softbox and still really throw some light around with those.
Right.
With constant light, that's always the struggle. The more you modify it, the more you lose, and you're never getting enough output out of these guys.
Well, exactly. And, whether you're using constant light for video or stills, I mean, it can be useful on many different scales. I've been looking at a good kind of diffuse constant light source for some of my summertime macro stuff, insects running along twigs and things like that, where I really want to have the light fill in everything. But those solutions are either expensive or obscure. So how expensive is this?
So if you're looking at the 120, kind of that 1K equivalent, those guys are going for Canadian about $800 right now, and then $1,300 for the 300D. Okay. So we're well under, if you're looking for something equivalent, there's some bi-color options and things like that out there. But most of the ones that are comparable to that are going to run kind of the $2,000 to $2,800.
Really? Mark. So it's a significant step down in price, but yeah. You're saying the quality is every bit as good as the more expensive units.
Yeah, I don't tend to shoot with do a lot of testing in terms of CRIs and things like that. I find it's largely not that applicable. I just look at skin tone, and these are the best skin tones that I've seen coming off an LED for, again, under a couple thousand dollars. We were recently working on a film set where we had access to a lot of really great high output, very expensive fixtures, you know, $5,000 and up. And I just kept falling back on the cob light because it's easy to work with. And I was less terrified if it fell off a crane or something like that. You know,
exactly. Would it be durable?
Affordable for its class.
Again, the brand does not say durable to me. Have you knocked it around and it's still working?
Yeah, we've been using that guy for close to a year now. And I use it on nearly every project for a couple things, whether it's product shots or interviews. And it's still been going solid.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you for that pick, Jordan. Now, where can people find you? I know that you are the man behind and sometimes in front of the camera at a DP Review TV, right?
Yes. So it's just a youtube.com/DP Review to check those out. We put up shoot for an episode a week coming out of there. And you can also find me. Twitter is probably the easiest way to actually engage, have a conversation, and that's at that Jordan Drake. And I'm also on Instagram. I'm working on putting photographs into that, I think we'll do here this year, because right now it's just a bunch of cell phone BTS stuff to let people know what's coming up on the channel soon. But this is the year, 2019, I'm going to put pictures on it.
Awesome. And, I'm excited. I don't think I've actually seen you take a picture. It's always been video stuff. So
yeah,
looking forward to seeing what comes of that.
It's changing.
Make sure that you follow Jordan everywhere that you can. The links to all of his social media stuff and to DP Review TV will be in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com. I want to thank everybody for listening. You can find me personally at donkom.ca, donkom.ca, where you'll find my work, my links, and my upcoming workshops, for which I have some great full-day macro photography workshops. I've got a trip to Iceland coming up in late October of this year, which will be hopefully less full of tourists and darker skies for some beautiful auroras, which will be a ton of fun. And it's not a huge crowd that's going, so you'll have a lot of one-on-one attention from me for that workshop. It's one of the ones I'm really excited about for this year. So you can find that at doncom.ca. Show notes at photogeekweekly.com. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. It's time to get out and shoot.